Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, what Mike Pence wants and how he spent his career trying to achieve it. We'll spend this hour with journalist Tom LoBianco, who has covered the man who is now vice president since his days running for Congress in Indiana. LoBianco will tell us about how Pence's religious convictions have shaped his political positions on LGBTQ and reproductive rights, and about times when Pence has been willing to endorse progressive policies like Medicaid expansion and public pre-K. We'll hear about why Donald Trump selected Pence as his running mate in 2016, and about how much influence Pence's wife Karen has on his views, decisions, and career. Our conversation starts after a short break. Understand Vice President Mike Pence, his values, his political ambitions, what kind of chief executive he might be if he finds himself in the Oval Office, it's important to understand his most important influence. That influence is not President Trump. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. From the beginning of his career in elected office, and especially as governor of Indiana, some observers believe Mike Pence's lodestar has been his wife, Karen Pence. While Mike Pence has embraced deep fiscal and social conservatism in some arenas, he's also taken seriously his wife's requests for expanding Medicaid and public pre-K education in Indiana. Journalist Tom LoBianco is a political analyst for Fox News, MSNBC, and NPR. He began covering Mike Pence in the early days of his Indiana political career as a reporter for the Associated Press. His new book is called Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. He joins us from NPR in Washington to talk about it. Tom, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
So having read this book, I found myself also wanting a book-length study of Karen Pence. beyond the kinds of support and sacrifices just expected of a political spouse, what sort of role has she played in Mike Pence's career?
You know, this is something, when I started reporting on him, so back in June in 2011 when he was first running for governor, I would hear chatter off and on about how much Karen Pence really ran the show. And I often kind of took that to be an exaggeration. As I worked on this project, as I worked on this book, I found it to be true. And I think there's a caricature of her that is out there as sort of a schoolmarm, like a moralist, like, you know, rap you on the knuckles style. And I think that kind of misses what she really is. And it's they are, from their start, from when they get married in 1985 all through now, it's like a joint political career. It is a mutual political career. Mike Pence is the front-facing part of that, but they work together in all decisions. And, you know, I guess if you're conservative, if you're Republican, you probably like that and probably think that's a good thing. If you're, you know, more left of center Democrat, that probably comes across as suspicious. But she is incredibly important in his world.
Expanding Medicaid and pre-K in Indiana sound like progressive causes. Was there backlash of Mike Pence's decision at Karen Pence's insistence that he take up these issues in Indiana?
Well, at the time when this happened, so they do the, it was a pre-K pilot program back in 2014. And as I write in the book, and I didn't know this at the time. I didn't find this out until I was doing the research for the book. He has some state senators over to the governor's residence for pizza and watch some basketball, and it's a lobbying effort. And they tell him, they say, look, we don't want to do this pre-K program. It's extra money. You tell us you're a fiscal conservative. We don't want to do it. And he just tells him, he says, you know what? Karen wants to do it, so we're going to do it. You didn't see her hand very often. It was hard to pick out from day to day. The other part was the Medicaid expansion, and that happens in 2015. Her big reason for doing that was because of the high infant mortality rates in Indiana. And that continues to be a thing. for her, a big focus, wanting to drive down those infant mortality rates. It sort of comes in the sort of the pro-life, anti-abortion worldview, but that continues to be a big push. Maybe not expanding Medicaid it so much, but wanting to drive down infant mortality. And you know, one of the reasons that we didn't know about this was because she wouldn't make a lot of these proclamations in public. She wouldn't do big press events, and nothing like that. She also wouldn't be seen in meetings pushing her husband, pushing Mike Pence to do this. It was more she would call from her office across the hallway from the governor's office and call over to him, and they would discuss policy. And in that way, nobody inside the state capitol, the state house, would be able to see her walking across the hallway and influencing him. So they've done a very good job of kind of trying hiding her hand a little bit. I don't entirely know why that is. I have a few ideas on it. I just know that they don't like to put her out front.
Here's Karen Pence with Mike Pence on the Today Show just before the election in 2016.
I want to get to Mrs. Pence first, ladies first, and it's such a pleasure to have you here. My question for you, Mrs. Pence, what's the best piece of advice you've given your husband since he joined the Trump ticket?
Really just be himself and have fun with this. It's so humbling and it's such an honor. We're in a position right now that 2 months ago we had no idea we would be in, and he's done a great job,
Governor,
staying himself and staying humble.
Have fun with this doesn't necessarily sound like you're making plans for the next 4 years. The story that you tell of Karen Pence's response to the surprise victory of Trump in 2016 is really interesting. What happened there?
So on election night, it's about 1:30 a.m., so I guess it would have been Wednesday, November 9th by that point, and they get the call from Hillary Clinton conceding the election. And Mike Pence overhears this, and he goes to lean into Karen and says, "We won," leans in for a kiss. And Karen turns away, and she says, "You got what you wanted, Michael. Now leave me alone." You know, I'd heard that story before. It's been out there before in various places. The first time I heard it, I wasn't entirely sure I believed it, because it seemed to lack, as the stories go, and you know, I mean, you know from being in this world of political reporting, I mean, even long before Trump ever arrived, we were awash in, misinformation. That just is part of the game. It's gotten worse since he's got there. But that's always been an occupational hazard as a political reporter. And I didn't really believe it, because it seemed almost amateur for a political couple that is so used to being in the spotlight. Later, I've talked to a few more people who were there to witness this, and I kind of came to a different understanding of it. Originally, I thought it was because she was angry with Trump. And I think that there's certainly among Trump's people, they know that she does not like the president. That's something that the Pence people have been working to kind of rectify, or at least rectify that image. But as I reported this out more, it became clear to me that it wasn't because she was angry at Trump. It was because she was angry at her husband. It was angry at Mike. And the reason why is because they had made a political gamble when they signed on with Trump in July of 2016. The gamble was that they would only have to do 4 months at Trump's side, 4 months of carrying the water for Trump. And this is even before things like Stormy Daniels came out. They knew there were problems. But it wouldn't be so bad if you only had to do it for 4 months. And one of the reasons, there's a couple of reasons that we know this. One is when they refused to leave the ticket during the Access Hollywood weekend in October of 2016, they're given that option to either replace Trump at the top of the ticket or to leave the ticket and kind of preserve their image. And the answer to both of those options ends up being no. And the reason why is because why would you do that when all you have to do is wait 30 days And then he is the front runner for the nomination in 2020. And that was kind of their thinking. And, you know, we know this because his people were out there lining up Republican donors, telling them before the November 2016 election, telling them, look, get on the Pence train early. You'll get a good seat at the table. You know, we're lining up for 2020. Every expectation was that he would lose, or that Trump would lose. And so when Trump wins, they lose, because now it's going from having to carry the water for Trump for 4 months to 4 years and possibly 8 years. And it creates the discord that we're seeing now. You know, the previous image that they like to have out there of Mike Pence as a nice guy is just a complete contrast with the, you know, a guy who insults people regularly on Twitter. That was why. And look, sometimes I even think that her political acumen is almost more innate and more honed than his political acumen.
So Mike Pence's origin story often refers to growing up in a house that overlooked a cornfield, which is not a lie, but creates a perception of who he is and where he comes from that perhaps is not entirely accurate.
That's right. Yeah. When we when I started covering him in June 2011, he does his campaign kickoff in his hometown of Columbus, Indiana. And he used to use this as sort of a throwaway phrase. A lot of people had been talking to him about running for president in 2012. The movement conservatives really liked him, and this group called the Council for National Policy was really big on him trying to make a run for president. And he would brush it off by saying, you know, look, I'm just a kid from a small town in southern Indiana who grew up with a cornfield in his backyard. And it's a toss-away line. So when I went to Columbus for the first time, I see this really beautiful city, and I learn more about it. And it's not like a one-stop town in the middle of a couple of cornfields. It's a pretty, you know, it's a mini metropolis. It has this beautiful architecture from these global architects, I.M. Pei, the Saarinen family, the people who designed the Arch in St. Louis, Dulles International Airport. I mean, these major, a piece of the Louvre, these major global architects. And there's a good story, I won't go too far off on a tangent, about the town father who did that, this man named J. Irwin Miller. But Pence didn't really grow up in a farming rural community. He grew up in a nice mid-sized city in a booming time in the manufacturing belt, in the Rust Belt. And so I always, when he would say that, I actually took it to be completely false. I didn't believe it. So when I was working on the book, we drove down to one of his boyhood home at the end of Hall Creek Boulevard, and lo and behold, there's a cornfield, and I couldn't believe it. and the truth of it is, I mean, technically he's accurate, but the truth of it is that it was there because his family was moving into each new subdevelopment that was eating into the cornfields as the city expanded outward in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. And that's kind of, it was deeper, and it showed, to me at least, for him, it showed that there's more to this guy than we see. And then he kind of hides it on purpose. So that's really where I started with this. You know, I carried around, I plucked a tassel of corn on my second trip out of there, and I kind of carried it around with me as like a miniature talisman to remind me.
Did he grow up with money?
He does. His parents come down from Chicago, Ed Pence Jr. and Nancy Pence. And his father is a regional oil salesman for this Keel Brothers Oil Company. And southern Indiana, the Ohio River Valley, that area. And he rises to a position of vice president. They get money. They don't start out with money. They get money. And it's around the same time that the city itself is booming. Columbus is booming. And, you know, look, he sells off a bunch of his gas stations, Marathon gas stations, in the 80s, and then gives each one of his kids about $1 million. And there's six Pence siblings. Mike Pence loses it, actually. His friend, one of his best friends, loses it in a private placement. the Pences kind of start with money, but they've always struggled with money throughout their career. That ends up being a theme that it impacts them throughout.
My guest is Tom LoBianco. He's a journalist who analyzes politics for Fox News, MSNBC, and NPR. His book is Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. We'll be right back.
There I was, a few days ago in New York City, with the man who won 37 states, who faced 16 talented opponents and outlasted every one of them, and along the way brought millions of new voters into the Republican Party. You know, he's a man known for a large personality, a colorful style, and lots of charisma, and so I guess he was just looking for some balance on the ticket. Well, for those of you who don't know me, which is most of you, I grew up on the front row of the American Dream.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was Vice President Mike Pence, at the time candidate Mike Pence, at the 2016 Republican National Convention. My guest this hour is journalist Tom LoBianco. We're talking about his new book, Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. Certainly, Tom, in that speech we hear Mike Pence's ability to be sort of self-deprecating and charming. Why did a guy like Donald Trump want someone like Mike Pence on the ticket with him?
Well, you know, it's funny. Trump kind of gets forced into it. And, you know, I detail this extensively in the book, reporting out a lot of stuff for the first time here in this one period. So I kind of zone in on this July 12th, 2016, 13th, July 14th, July 15th, 2016, this 72-96-hour period that basically decides the fate of Pence on the ticket, but in a sense really also it establishes that Trump will, you know, win the election. It's a pivotal moment. There's going into this, and you got to rewind a little bit and remember where we were in the 2016 campaign back then. You know, the Republican Party was not unified behind Trump back then the way that it is now. And there were a number of efforts being largely led by Ted Cruz's people to deny Trump the nomination at the Republican convention. At the same time, they had been going around, the Trump campaign had been going around to sort of moderate slash establishment slash movement conservatives. Basically, everybody they had pissed off and trashed during the 2016 campaign, trying to find somebody who could kind of like bring conservatives back into the fold. And, you know, there's people like Bob Corker who they considered. I write in the book that Trump asked his team to check out Ivanka Trump as a running mate. They went back to him. They're like, well, it's nepotism. That might be more trouble than it's worth. They reached out to women governors throughout the country, Mary Fallon, the former governor of Oklahoma, Suzanne Martinez, and everyone was turning them down. So by the time you get to July of 2016, and remember that convention is, what, July 20th, 2016, where Trump is going to get the nomination, and also the running mate will be nominated, the vice presidential pick. They're in a weakened, the Trump people are in a weakened position. So they really have just three candidates who are being seriously considered and want to be considered. That's the other part of this that I think gets kind of forgotten with the fog of time. It's Newt Gingrich, who Jared and Ivanka are really behind. They're pushing him very hard. Chris Christie, who has a close relationship with Trump himself, but is being blocked by Jared Kushner because he helped put Kushner's dad in jail when he was a prosecutor. And then Mike Pence. And Pence is like an afterthought for the most part. It's people like Paul Manafort and Reince Priebus are pushing Pence because they know that it will be good for bringing conservatives back into the fold. But sort of the Trump loyalists, the Trump family, they're not really hot on Pence. In their minds, he's a little weird with the religion piece. That's not something that they're used to. And they also remember how he endorsed Ted Cruz in the primary, the Indiana primary in May of 2016. And everyone's very skittish with him. And so what changes is that they get a flat tire. The Trump campaign pops a flat tire on a trip to Indianapolis. And
on their airplane.
The Trump campaign pops a flat tire on a 757. It gets stranded in Indianapolis on July 12th, 2016. It's a Tuesday. So he's going to be out there for an event. He gets forced to stay over there. The next morning, he meets with Pence at the governor's mansion. They have this brass tacks moment. This is, and I report this out for the first time in the book. Trump looks at Pence and he says, "Why do you want this?" He says, "I need killers. Are you going to be a killer?" He holds up his phone. He's like, "Christie is calling me all the time, and he wants this." He's like, "What do you want? It's like, will you be a killer?" And Pence, he has this like preternatural calm about him, almost like he doesn't care whether he's acting like he doesn't care whether he gets it or not. And some of that is genuine. That's sort of like a peace with whatever God's decision is. That's how they're approaching this. Mm-hmm. And he says, "You know what? I'm not a killer. I'm not going to be that guy. But if you want somebody who will help you pass legislation, help you fundraise, bring conservatives back home, work in the Midwest, I'll be that guy." And Trump's kind of a little befuddled by this. So he looks at him. He says, "Why don't you want this?" And Pence looks back at him. He says, "Well, to be honest, you're sitting on my couch in my home. Your whole family's here. The feeling must be mutual. Why do you want me?" And I'll just tease this out a little bit here. I'm trying to get better at teasing. That, in the moment, seems like it's the thing that locks it in for Mike Pence, right? He shows that he's got some gusto to him that you almost never see, and Trump is impressed by this. But it doesn't, because Trump is backing out already the next day. Trump gives him the offer that Wednesday night, July 13th, 2016, and Pence says yes. But he's already backing out the next day. So it's something that I put in the book for the first time, that Mike Pence's people do the very next day, which actually makes him the running mate. And it provides a level of depth to Pence that we rarely see, and I think helps inform why he should be taken seriously as a serious presidential contender.
What role did Kellyanne Conway play in the matchmaking?
Not much, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
She was very, I'll tell you this, she is very close with Mike Pence, and has been with him for 10 years, but she's got a lot of clients. She was a Ted Cruz person throughout 2016 before becoming a Trump person. And she was not, she would push Mike Pence as a good option in meetings. But the people who were really pushing, and I based this off my reporting from a couple different areas. You know, we're trying to figure out, you know, what the heck is actually going on. You know, I try to get different factions within Trump world and then match it against what I'm hearing from Pence world, and try to, like, triangulate, you know, what the heck is actually going on with this. To the best I could tell, it was Paul Manafort, Reince Priebus were pushing him. And then there's another guy named Stephen Hilbert, who has a pretty colorful background. He met his wife when she jumped out of a papier-mâché cake topless at the bachelor party for his stepson from his second marriage. And he was really tight with Donald Trump. They did casino stuff together in Indiana. And Hilbert, that's H-I-L-B-E-R-T, plays a very big role in getting Mike Pence on the ticket. The Kellyanne stuff was overstated, and I've seen that in other reporting. I think I did not come across evidence of that, but she is very important in Pence's circle, to be certain.
Pence is well known for personally opposing abortion. He's also been accused of supporting laws that discriminate against LGBTQ rights, which is a position that led him into one of the more contentious exchanges he's had with a journalist in his career. Before we play a little bit of that sound from a 2015 conversation with George Stephanopoulos, can you give us some background on the Indiana policy that they would be talking about?
Sure. This was called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and it was kind of the consolation prize to the Christian right conservatives in Indiana because they had actually lost a battle over gay marriage the year before. So this was like the consolation prize they were throwing to them. Pence had nothing to do with it at the beginning because he didn't want anything to do with it when this was being debated in December 2014, January 2015. And he kind of swoops in at the last minute to take credit for it when he sees that there won't be any political repercussions to it. And that's at the end of March 2015. And that's right when this thing explodes. There's a Facebook post from George Takei, Mr. Sulu, and he talks about, it's very moving, he talks about how he knows exactly what this legislation is. It's the same legislation that put his family in the internment camps in World War II. And that's what leads directly into this just astounding interview with George Stephanopoulos. I mean, I'm still shocked by it, you know, four or five years later.
Final question, final yes or no question, Governor. Do you think it should be legal in the state of Indiana to discriminate against gays or lesbians?
George,
it's a yes or no question.
Hoosiers don't believe in discrimination. I mean, the way I was raised in a small town in southern Indiana is you're kind and caring and respectful to everyone. Anybody that's been in Indiana for 5 minutes knows that Hoosier hospitality is not a slogan. It's a reality. People tell me when I travel around the country, gosh, I went to your state and people are so nice. I mean, this is not about discrimination. This is about protecting the religious liberty of every Hoosier of every faith, and we're going to continue to work our hearts out to clarify that to the people of Indiana and the people of this great country.
Yes or no, should it be legal to discriminate against gays and lesbians?
George, you're following the mantra of the last week online, and you're trying to make this issue about something else. What I am for is protecting, at the highest standards in our courts, the religious liberty of Hoosiers. I signed the bill. We're going to continue to explain it to people that don't understand it. And if possible, we will find a way to amplify what this bill really is in the legislative process. But I stand by this law. It was an important step forward when Bill Clinton signed it in 1993. It's an important step forward to keeping the promises of our Bill of Rights and the First Amendment and our Indiana Constitution. And I'm proud that Indiana's adopted the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Governor Pence, thank you very much for your time.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Just to be clear for anyone who's confused, Tom Lobianco, Hoosier just means it refers to someone who lives in Indiana.
Right. Yes.
So you note throughout the book that Mike Pence is not really an ideologue. He's not an innovator. He doesn't really love being pinned down on what his specific opinions are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And that kind of, it was a little surprising to me at first, as I went deeper, because, you know, I kind of came at it as a when I first started covering him from, well, you know, you hear what you hear about him, right? You know, he's a theocrat, is a hard right Tea Party, some people call him a T-evangelical, you see the caricatures, and then certainly that George Stephanopoulos interview just reinforces it. But what I found throughout his career is that He's within the lanes of, like, generally the Republican right. He stays in those lanes, but he's always shifting. You know, in 1988, when he first runs for Congress, he's trained at the Newt Gingrich Campaign School in Washington, and he runs a Newt Gingrich-style race. It's, you know, tarring your opponent. That's not surprising. Plenty of Democrats do that, too. It's what the challengers do when they're running against incumbents. He dumps that later in his career because he figures it doesn't work for him. Then he becomes, but he doesn't take sides in this kind of rift that's developing inside the Republican Party between George H.W. Bush and the establishment and an upstart, this guy named Pat Robertson, right? One of the founders of the Moral Majority, the Christian right, politicization of the evangelical right. And Robertson runs as this sort of this populist Christian right attack on George H.W. Bush and the establishment. And Pence never takes sides in that. But by 1992, Pence has taken sides with Pat Buchanan, who's kind of the latest iteration of that. Throughout the 90s, he's kind of a Rush Limbaugh-style conservative. By 2000, he's a softened-style Christian conservative. By 2009, he's kind of Tea Party, but not really. By 2012, he's running for governor. He drops all the Tea Party stuff and the Christian right stuff to become like a technocrat in the style of Mitch Daniels, the former governor. And then by 2016, he's a Trump Republican. And I think that's who Pence is. I think he's a guy who's constantly changing to win because he's a politician, you know, first and foremost.
He was raised Catholic, but sort of saved in the evangelical sense way back in 1978. Why did it take him so long to start identifying as such and worshiping in evangelical churches?
Oh, that's a great question. And to be honest with you, I still don't entirely know why. Here's what we do know. 1978, he has this his experience at the his salvation experience at the Ichthys Music Festival in Lexington, right outside Lexington, Kentucky. And but he doesn't start going to an evangelical church until 1994 when his family starts going there. So what happens in the 16 years in between, right? You know, him and Karen get married in the Catholic Church. They meet in the Catholic Church. They meet in the Vatican II Church. It's pretty liberal for folks who don't know Catholicism that well. It's a fairly liberal style of Catholicism. They stay there for 16 years. And I think it ends up being very hard for him to leave the church, capital T, capital C, because his family is still there. It's a number of things, but it's kind of the final thing that happens, and you see this throughout his life, is he's not a very driven person. He's often pushed by other people. And what finally happens is that the pastor at this the Greenwood Community Church just south of Indianapolis, a man named Jim Dodson, D-O-D-S-O-N, kind of comes and says, "Mike, you know, you should come and lead our church group for young men." Pence keeps on canceling the meetings with him. And finally, on the sixth try, he has coffee with this guy, and he agrees to it. And that's kind of the final push. But it's a very long, and you know, look, when I was studying the religion part of this, you know, I would hear this very often. You hear often about the zealotry of converts, but you don't often hear about the kind of the longer transitions, the ones that take 16 years or so. And you have a lot of that when people are leaving something like the Catholic Church that they've grown up with. You know, it's really unique to each individual, and it takes a very long time for him. And something that I would like to hear more from him about, because he makes it sound, when he talks about it, like it's a very clean and quick transformation in 1978, but that's really not how it happened.
My guest is journalist Tom LoBianco. His new book is Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. We'll be right back. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest, Tom LoBianco, is a political analyst for Fox News, MSNBC, and NPR, and has a new book out called Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. Tom, as vice president, you tell us that Mike Pence is not a vice president in the style of Dan Quayle, which is to say just brushed aside and kept out of trouble, but he's also no Dick Cheney. So what does that mean, and where is he somewhere in the middle?
I think there's kind of two caricatures of him that have emerged in the 3 years of the Trump administration. You know, either one of a Svengali is secretly pulling the strings of Trump, just a glorified coat rack. You know, the sort of that elf on the shelf moment in that. look, there's some measure of truth to both of those, but he's really somewhere more in the middle. And he kind of picks and chooses, of course, is very, very influential on the pro-life stuff, the anti-abortion stuff, and he kind of makes that a big area for him. Same for Obamacare, for the Health and Human Services, trying to get rid of Obamacare through executive action. But he's not the most influential power player inside the Trump administration. You know, he certainly doesn't rise to the rank of somebody like Jared Kushner. You know, Steve Bannon in his time had that. He doesn't have it anymore. But I think part of that is on purpose because, you know, look at the people who fly too close to the sun. Remember, you know, Bannon first gets kicked out in large part because he has this that Time magazine cover calling him the shadow president. Hmm. And then he only cements that further with that the Michael Wolff book that came out. And Pence kind of sees all this and, you know, rightfully so. I mean, if his goal is survival to 2024 to try and win the presidency in his own right, his goal is to keep his head down. And that's largely what he's doing. You know, he'll pick his spots, but he's not a forceful presence.
Would you call his efforts to dismantle Obamacare a reversal of what he did as governor of Indiana to expand Medicaid?
No. He always said that he wanted to get rid of Obamacare. You know, he uses the term, you know, repeal it lock, stock, and barrel. I don't know what that means. I don't know where the guns come in with the healthcare policy, but you know, he did the Medicaid expansion, you know, for a number of different reasons. You know, Karen figured heavily into that. The hospitals out there figured heavily into that. They lobbied him very hard on that. And he also kind of felt like they could do it in a conservative fashion, sort of something that wouldn't look like it was pure Medicaid. But at the end of the day, that's what he wants to do. He wants to get rid of Obamacare. And, you know, you saw that when his office was very heavily involved with the lobbying on at the beginning of the Trump administration, trying to get the votes in the House to repeal Obamacare. It ended up not working, and he got blamed for some of that, frankly. It did drive a wedge between him and Trump for a little bit, not permanent. But, you know, like if he had it his way, yeah, absolutely, they'd get rid of it.
How seriously should we take these rumors that the Trump team has at least talked about ejecting Pence from the 2020 ticket and replacing him with Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador?
Definitely real. And I heard some of those. I reported this out in the story. So after I finished the book, right, I reported this out in the story for Yahoo News. And it was real. The talk was real. Now, I don't know how real it was that they were actually very likely to get rid of Pence. And I think what you saw there was Nikki Haley and her team kind of rush into the gap and say, do that whole dance where it's like, oh, we'd never want to support getting rid of Mike Pence. He's such a great guy. You know, by the way, my name is Nikki Haley. That's spelled with two Ks. You know, I think they saw an opportunity to win some political chits there. And, you know, look, those two are more than likely running against each other for the nomination in 2024. But I always thought, I hear this from my Trump sources, you know, originally what they wanted to do, they wanted a woman in there because they're thinking out, Ivanka in particular, were kind of gaming out. And I should say that Ivanka denies this jointly. They deny this. But they were gaming out, how do you get women voters in the suburbs back into the fold with Trump? I mean, I'm not sure you can do that. But they were talking out, how do you do that? And they were talking about a woman running mate. And, you know, it's not as where they were in 2016. Remember, they're trying to go after the women governors unsuccessfully. And, you know, look, it's, I don't think Haley is the one necessarily. I just think she ran into the gap on that and kind of saw a chance. It could be Ivanka. I've heard some people float that idea before. It could be anyone else. And it's also not that surprising. Let me put a little history on this, too. In 1992, Pence actually writes an opinion piece when he's at a conservative think tank telling the Bush administration, don't dump Dan Quayle from the ticket, because if you dump Quayle, you will lose the conservatives. And that was some real chatter at the time. The White House was seriously thinking about that. They were thinking about replacing Quayle with James Baker. And, you know, would they actually have done it? Who knows? It's not that surprising. You heard some of this with Biden and Obama about 8 years ago coming into the reelect. There's always chatter about it. You know, to me, what's always more interesting is how people respond to it. And that Nikki Haley rushing into the gap was very telling.
To the extent that attaching someone like Mike Pence to Donald Trump's campaign helped to draw in and frankly, soothe evangelical voters, is there any doubt that those same voters will support President Trump again in 2020 with or without an evangelical on the ticket?
Well, so there's a former Christian right pastor. He's still an evangelical pastor. His name is Robert Schenck, S-C-H-E-N-C-K. And I interview him for a number of places throughout the book. He used to pray with Pence in his office. He gave him the Ten Commandments award, these miniature stone tablets. You know, he used to chain himself in front of Planned Parenthood clinics. And he makes a really good point about this. He says that at the beginning, his evangelical friends kind of rationalized Trump by saying, look, he'll lose in 2016, same thing everyone thought. And then Mike Pence, one of their guys, will be in the front running for the 2020 nomination. So it's a good thing. Then when Trump wins, they kind of rationalize, oh, well, Trump will be impeached because look at this Russia scandal that's evolving. You know, it's Trump. You know, of course he got himself into trouble. And then when that didn't happen, then they kind of decided, that, well, okay, we got Neil Gorsuch, and then we got Brett Kavanaugh. We got all these lower court picks. They're getting the anti-abortion policies that they want, chipping away at that through executive action. And they start kind of rationalizing Trump, and they're like, hey, you know what? He might talk terribly and insult people and be just, you know, philanderer and Stormy Daniels and you name it, but we're getting what we want. And I think this is where you have a little bit of tension with Trump and Pence and sort of the political side of things, which is, do you need Pence anymore? Now, his people will tell you, yes, absolutely, because Pence is, he still assuages that world. Some of Trump's people would tell you, nope, they're on board with Trump and we could go with whoever we like. I don't know that the answer is entirely clear right now. They've certainly gravitated more towards Trump, but I don't know that Trump has a lock on that world of sort of the Christian right voter.
What can you tell us about Mike Pence's interactions with Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, what was fascinating is so the book published on September 24th, right when Nancy Pelosi announced the impeachment inquiry. And I had covered the Trump-Russia investigation, and one of the things that struck me about this versus the Russia probe was how much Pence was wrapped into it. You know, during Russia, he was not in the thick of things, and kind of a reflection of how he was not very tight inside of Trump world, to be honest. But now you saw that he had that meeting on September 1st. He delivers the message to Zelensky in person. He says he got to fight corruption practices. You know, the ambassador, EU ambassador Gordon Sondland, says that they told Mike Pence that, yes, the military aid was fashioned on leveraging the investigation into the Bidens. I will tell you then, and Pence's office vehemently denies knowing any of this. You know, what did you know when, right? I'll tell you that his response that he gave to Sondland has a lot of a sort of a Pence perch kind of laughing, because it's a response that he gives to a lot of people. He just nods his head.
Hmm.
So what does a head nod mean? He hasn't dedicated himself, committed himself one way or the other on this. So I think that's kind of, both things could be true, right? Sondland tells him, yeah, this is about leveraging an investigation into Trump's main political opponent. And Pence could be like, yeah, I don't know if I acknowledge hearing that. But he's in trouble. You know, look, the House Intelligence Committee, which is kind of the lead investigators on this, they advanced their recommendations for articles of impeachment, and that's obviously going on right now, the Judiciary Committee. But they're also continuing to investigate the other players involved in this, people like Mike Pence. They put out a request for additional information on his September 18th phone call with Zelensky. The VP's office has been stonewalling. While the Trump impeachment itself continues, people like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo and Rick Perry. So he's not out of the woods yet. I don't know that he escapes this thing unscathed.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You describe Mike Pence as a caretaker sort of public servant, the kind of person who comes in after a big change that someone else has made and tidies up. How do you imagine Pence might tidy up if, under whatever circumstance, he follows President Trump into the Oval Office?
Well, for one thing, I think we're going to see the end of Twitter diplomacy. I don't think you'll see him getting into any nuclear whatever sword fights with Kim Jong-un on Twitter and insulting people. I think the insults would end, frankly. And I think I know actually from my Republican sources, there's a lot of people who would like that on the Republican side. They're just really done with Trump ripping people to shreds constantly. So things would get a lot more staid. I think you would see a return to a turn away from some of the isolationist style foreign policy of Trump towards more sort of neoconservative George W. Bush foreign policy. And you've seen that in some of Pence's own speeches, in particular about China. I don't think you would see a return on trade. And this was one of the big flip-flops from him. You know, he'd been a free trade guy for years and years and years, 28 years, something like that, 30 years. But now he's a quasi-fair trade guy, where the unions are, fittingly enough. And I don't think that changes because he knows that the path to victory is through the Rust Belt. So I think Trump has fundamentally altered the Republican Party in that sense. And Pence goes where the success is, where the base is. He's not a very strong executive. He's not a very strong manager. And, you know, we see that the most from his time as governor. I don't think that he would be a very forceful presence. He takes a very long time to make decisions. Where Trump is a little sporadic and chaotic and you're never really entirely sure what decision he has made, Pence would take a long time and is very opaque about his decision making. But you would know at the end of it what the decision is. He's not going to flip flop at the end of it. Things would slow down immensely. I don't think Saturday Night Live would be covering the White House anymore.
You said the process of writing this book made you more empathetic toward Mike Pence. What did you think about him before you started researching that changed in the course of this reporting?
He just, you know, at the start of it, he felt very plastic to me. And there's still a side of him that's like that. It's the side that we see in public. I'd always felt that, you know, I've covered four governors, two in Maryland, two in Indiana, number of congressmen, state lawmakers, White House. And he just felt like the one politician I've covered where I never really understood him as a person. As I did this research, like there's a person buried deep down in there, but we just never see him in public. You know, the guy who makes those self-deprecating jokes. We don't see a lot of that anymore. And, you know, I kind of felt bad for him. But at the same time, you know, look, he has made a decision that his ambition is what he wants to follow. That's not terrible. Plenty of ambitious people go follow the ambition. That's why he's at Trump's side. If you like Trump, that's probably a good thing. And if you don't like Trump, it's a bad thing. The ambition, that was really kind of shocking to me. I underestimated his ambition before.
Journalist Tom LoBianco is a political analyst for Fox News, MSNBC, and NPR. His new book is called Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. Tom, thanks so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERAThink. Subscribe to our podcast and learn about upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.